More than 5,000 ships left Ireland during the Great Potato Famine in the late 1840s, transporting the starving and the destitute away from their stricken homeland. The first vessel to sail in the other direction to help the millions unable to escape was the USS Jamestown, a converted warship which left Boston in March 1847, loaded with precious food for Ireland. In an unprecedented move by Congress, the warship had been placed in civilian hands, stripped of its guns, and committed to the peaceful delivery of food, clothing, and supplies in a mission that would launch America's first full-blown humanitarian relief effort. In the new book, Voyage of Mercy, it tells the incredible story of the famine, the Jamestown voyage, and the commitment of thousands of ordinary Americans to offer relief to Ireland, a groundswell that provided the collaborative blueprint for future relief efforts and established the U.S. as a leader in international aid. Again, the name of the book is Voyage of Mercy, the USS Jamestown, the Irish Famine, and the remarkable story of America's first humanitarian mission. And it's a great pleasure to welcome author and historian Stephen Pulio to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joe. Pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to the USS Jamestown and this particular mission?
Well, I had come across the Jamestown mission. I'm from the Boston area, and the Jamestown did sail from Boston. I came across it in some previous research, but was never really fully aware of the true scope of the Jamestown voyage itself and the incredible mission behind it. That is, where Americans from all across the country donated an incredible amount of food over the next 15 to 18 months to Ireland. So the original research, I just wanted to do a little bit more on the ship itself. I was kind of fascinated that Congress had decommissioned a warship and set it aside for humanitarian purposes. But then behind the Jamestown came pretty close to 150 ships over the next 15 to 18 months, as I say, delivering food, direct aid food, more than money, this is food, to the starving people of Ireland. So the story just grew once I began that research.
You start off the book in Ireland, and that is the first part of the book, with the quote, "The food of a whole nation has perished." So just set us straight on what was happening in Ireland that made that mission necessary.
Sure. In the summer of 1846, a potato blight strikes Ireland and destroys almost the entire potato crop. At that time, maybe about 30% of Ireland's population relied exclusively on the potato. And that followed an 1845 year of a really poor crop, not a great crop. So by the fall and late fall and December of 1846, famine had already struck Ireland and had in a big way. The winter was cold, lots of snow, lots of wind, and virtually nothing for the Irish people to eat. In January, late January of 47, so just a few months later, the first ships arrive from Ireland with people who are fleeing the famine and stories about the situation in Ireland itself. And it's at that point that the United States decides to take action and, for the first time in history, embark on this widespread, unprecedented relief mission for the people of Ireland.
You write in the chapter regarding the United States, so as 1846 came to a close, the United States was focused on geographic expansion, economic growth, breakthroughs in communications and transportation, war with Mexico, the angst of slavery, and the path to its destiny. The Irish crisis, you write, was but a footnote in the American story, except for its possible benefits to the U.S. economy. What were those benefits, and did that have anything to do with what happened when Robert Bennett Forbes enters this story?
So I think you're right. At the end of 1846, before word gets back, gets here as to how bad the situation was, America was thinking, well, maybe we could export some grains and corns to Ireland, and that might help on the overall world market. But once word comes, and once the situation is known about how bad things are, America comes together in a very amazing kind of way. People of all walks of life. People of all races and religions and creeds come together to decide to make these donations. So the vast majority of these donations come from the people themselves. There are committees that are set up across the United States, and Americans donate food that they have essentially, you know, planted and cultivated and harvested for their families and for sale to help them buy other goods. And instead, they decide to make these shipments to Ireland as a result of this overwhelming effort. Forbes, at a Boston meeting where the people of Boston are trying to decide what they're going to do, approaches his congressman at the time and makes this proposition that perhaps one of the ships in Boston, in the Navy Yard, in Charlestown, could be used and retrofitted and used for this mission of mercy. And Congress goes ahead and approves that in February of 1847.
Let us talk for a moment about Robert Bennett Forbes. You talk about him in the book. Give us an idea of who he is and what his resume was up until this point.
Sure. Forbes is a person who really has kind of a Hollywood-like existence up to that point. He is a sailor, had spent much of his time on ships. Made his first voyage across the Atlantic at the age of six with his mother when they're going to search for Forbes's ne'er-do-well father, who is working in Europe. By the age of 13, he's a cabin boy on a ship on a trip to China. At the age of 20, he's a commander of a ship on the way to China, engaged in mercantile activities, the opium trade at the time, which was legal. So he did that. And he said in his own words that between the ages of 17 and 27, he probably spent about 6 months of time on land when he wasn't aboard ship. At a time when most people didn't leave their hometowns, Forbes puts on thousands of miles at sea. He would end up in his life visiting five continents, was rich, became rich before he was 30, lost it all a few years later, and gets it all back around the age of 40. So at the time of the Jamestown mission, he has actually been home for about 6 years with his wife. They have children. It's a real kind of domestic existence. And when the news from Ireland strikes, Forbes says he's the person to lead this mission. And when asked why, he said, "It's not an everyday matter to see a nation starving."
Who's ultimately overseeing it in the sense of coordinating the efforts that led Forbes to do what he did, and also even coordinating the efforts by so many Americans to offer relief to Ireland?
So the initial impetus does come from the federal government. President James K. Polk, some of the big senators at the time, Daniel Webster, John C. Calhoun, Henry Clay's retired at that point, but he's part of this, and other senators established this committee in Washington, D.C., and the committee's job essentially is to encourage Americans in all cities and towns and villages and frontier outposts to establish committees for the relief of Ireland. That's what they do in February of 1847. Congress also then debates whether to contribute about $500,000 in cash toward Ireland's relief. And ultimately, that does not pass. The Senate does agree. The House has some questions. President Polk believes it might be unconstitutional to give American tax dollars to a foreign country. So that does not happen. And so what Congress's role basically is turning over the Jamestown for civilian use, decommissioning it as a warship, and decommissioning another ship, the USS Macedonian, in New York for civilian and humanitarian use. So that's basically their role. So this committee in Washington that Polk sets up, its role mainly is, as I say, a committee designed to encourage these kind of local committees that are set up in every city and town. And just about every city and town across the country, when I say across the country, I mean as far west at the time as Wisconsin, Michigan, along the Mississippi, they do set up one of these relief committees, and Americans in all of these towns contribute in a huge way.
I do want to say that you write about this in really stunning detail, especially in the third part of the book about Ireland. I mean, just some of the quotes: the whole country is one vast tomb. One of the chapter titles is "The Living Envy the Dead." You certainly lay it out the way it was, but it was a horrible, horrible situation in Ireland.
It was. I mean, I call this story, this American effort, a story of generosity and soaring goodwill, but against this backdrop of unfathomable despair. I mean, as I said, you had such a large part of the country that depended exclusively on the potato. As a result of the failure, not only could the Irish people not eat, they couldn't pay their rents. They were evicted in large numbers by English landlords, absentee landlords. So in the winter of 46 and 47, they are wandering the countryside of Ireland. Many of them are freezing. Many of them are sick with the attendant diseases that go along with starvation, things like typhus and dysentery. So it is really a desperate, desperate situation in Ireland at the time, almost indescribable. And I say that literally because many people who went to chronicle it, when you read the sources, say things like, "I'm going to leave the worst of this out. You know, things are so bad here. Here's a description, but the most graphic parts I am not going to include." So you're absolutely right. It was a terrible time in Ireland.
Stephen Pulio is the author of the new book, Voyage of Mercy, the USS Jamestown, the Irish Famine, and the Remarkable Story of America's First Humanitarian Mission. It is published by St. Martin's Press. I was emailing with you earlier before this interview, and I told you that I had just finished Patrick Radden Keefe's book, Say Nothing, which is about the Troubles and basically starts in the late 1960s. This book, and I read this book right after that, and this book gives incredible context because it's hard not to just think of the British as really evil.
Yeah, and I think you know that bitterness and that rancor between the Irish and the British that I think existed for 175 years, maybe right up until the turn of the 21st century.
And don't you think it continues today?
Beyond, I think to some extent, I think it's improved a little bit. Let's put it that way.
Okay,
but I mean the real, you know, sort of rancorous part, and which is the 20th century, I think. And by that, I mean, if you look at the Irish independence movement in the 1920s, if you look at the Troubles on the other end in the 70s and 80s, you know, and into the 90s, all influenced by the famine. And if you look right in the middle at the Second World War, which I do cover in the book, you'll know that Ireland does not want to become an ally with the British, even though Churchill does make these kind of overtures. The Irish do not do that. Ireland is one of six or seven nations that is considered neutral during the Second World War, and indeed some of its leadership considered even sympathetic to the Nazi cause because of this British issue. There were times in the 1940 and early 1941 when British ships could not even escape German U-boats by seeking refuge at Irish ports. The Irish run into a little trouble with that point of view after December 7th, 1941, when the U.S. gets into the war, because at that point, the bond between Ireland and the United States is very strong.
Right.
So there's lots of conflict in Ireland once the United States gets into the war about what the Irish should do. So they do remain as a country neutral, but many, many Irishmen do end up fighting on the side of the Allies during the Second World War. So the famine really has an impact for most of that 20th century. It really comes back to that. An Irish historian, right in 1999, said the famine is the unseen guest at every Irish dinner table.
Mm-hmm. Let us talk for a moment about just the subtitle of the book, which will help me frame the question, which is The Remarkable Story of America's First Humanitarian Mission. Give us a sense of when it starts to to become understood within Ireland and even in the United States that this humanitarian mission is helping and is actually very much a positive of what is happening.
Yeah, so I think very quickly. So the Jamestown is arrives in Ireland in Cork Harbor with tremendous anticipation on behalf of the Irish once they hear that it's underway. And then ship after ship that arrives in Dublin, in Londonderry, in Donegal, and Cork, and there's this groundswell of food coming from the United States of America at the same time, quite frankly, that other grains are being shipped out of Ireland by the British government as part of their overall, economic fortunes and overall economic policies. And so the Irish see on the one hand that the British are shipping food or exporting food out of Ireland, and on the other hand that the United States is contributing food to them. It is an unheard of thing. So up till this point, nations went to war with each other. They pillaged each other. They ravaged each other's crops and burned their cities and did all of that. And occasionally they traded with each other, no doubt about that. But this notion of a country for purely altruistic and humanitarian reasons, or the people of a country helping the people of another country, totally unheard of. And the Irish never forgot that. The bonds between the United States and Ireland remain strong to this day. Mm. And I think the main reason for that is the Jamestown mission and the mission that follows.
It is something you address, and it's a question I just like to ask just to be complete in our conversation. But when you look at even the troubles, as we mentioned, and even today, I mean, obviously a lot of this has to do with religion. How much in the philanthropy was it Catholic helping Catholic, or was it really U.S. helping Ireland?
So at the outset, it is Catholic helping Catholic. September of 46, right in that period of time, it's mostly a Catholic on Catholic help. But after that, religions across the United States help out. So, Methodists, Lutherans, Congregationalists, Jews, Quakers, Catholics, they all take part in this. The Quakers are a huge part of this assistance. It's also the other thing in terms of this is a big religious piece of this, I think. But the other thing is the various people from various walks of life that help here. Prisoners at Sing Sing contribute money at one point to Ireland. African-American churches, free churches in the north, and some slave churches in the south contribute. The Choctaw Indians contribute to this Irish cause. These are the people who were part of the Trail of Tears several years before the famine. And there was a strong bond between Ireland and the Choctaw Indians for years and years after that. So you have religions across the board that help, and I think not unusual at the time. The religions across the country were part of lots of movements, the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage movement, some of the prison reform movements all had a religious base. That does come into play, and it's religions of all types.
So as we look at a country right now that is in the throes of a pandemic, and a country that is part of a world that is in the throes of a pandemic, should we take some solace in that American spirit that we can help one another in this time?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think that's a really good point and a really good way to look at this. Americans are incredibly generous. They've been since the famine, and they continue to this day. And again, it's part of that public-private partnership that the famine, that the Jamestown mission and the famine set up. So, yes, there's a certain amount of government money that's given for humanitarian reasons, but more is given by the American people in the way of philanthropy. And that happens both domestically and internationally. So the American people domestically give about $420 billion to charity. That's a stunning amount of money. And of that, about 70 billion goes overseas. And then you add to that about another 50 billion of United States tax dollars that are given for humanitarian reasons. And I think that legacy has continued. And so it's certainly something that Americans can put into practice today as well during these difficult times.
Stephen Pulio's new book is Voyage of Mercy, the USS Jamestown, the Irish Famine, and the Remarkable Story of America's First Humanitarian Mission. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Again, Stephen Pulio's new book is Voyage of Mercy. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.